So if you'd like to have 1 Kings 18 again open, if you'd like to follow. We're looking at probably one of the most dramatic chapters in the Bible. It reads like a Hollywood film, even just the reading of it. Yet it's a real historical event, and it's recorded for a purpose for us. There is a real lesson in this for all of us here. Probably, I think, one of the most important things we could ever discover. So to kind of discover what it is, we're going to have to enter the drama, because it's put this way for a reason. It's so dramatic, we're supposed to be pulled into it and to feel what's going on. So we're going to just break this into four this morning. First, we're going to see the situation. Then we're going to hear this question that's asked. Then we're going to see the answer. And then we're going to see this mystery. It ends on a kind of mysterious note. So firstly, then, the situation. Let's try and plonk ourselves into this scene and try and get a feel of what's going on. So we jumped into the middle of it, into the middle of this chapter. What time are we in? Probably around 870 to 860 BC. So a long, long time ago. Where are we? Promised land. Israel now, essentially. But particularly the northern part, because it's split into two at this point. They should be one, but there's two kingdoms, which is a sign that things aren't great. And we're in the northern part, Samaria. Now, who's in this? Who's in this chapter? Who plays key roles? Well, we've got one man, King Ahab, which you noticed probably quite prominent in the reading. He's got a wife called Jezebel. You've probably heard about them, well known. People of Israel now, the second group. So we've got King Ahab, we've got this people of Israel. And we have to remember here that these are still the most privileged people in the world at that time. Yes, they're in a bad way, as we're going to see, but they hear from God. They are the one nation, the one people that hears from the God who made everything at that time. People of Israel. Then we've got the prophet Elijah, who speaks on behalf of God. He's been sent by God. But there's all these other prophets as well, which we're going to find out. He's one of the few. There's many others. So that's the kind of who, very briefly. But what was the situation? Well, the situation was absolute crisis. Well, you could call it a national crisis. Severe famine, no rain for 3 years. Now, that doesn't land with us. We'd love it if there was no rain in the UK. It was pouring with rain yesterday. We moan about the rain. We live in a Tesco supermarket generation. I had to mention Tesco there. I used to work for them. But the point is that we have to... Rain and lack of rain and famine doesn't really affect us. We've got food on tap. But I think we've actually got a good illustration of this for how serious it was with Sri Lanka. Were you here a few Sundays ago when we were hearing about Sri Lanka and they were begging for rain? If there was no rain, they wouldn't live. It's literally the life. We were praying for Sri Lanka to have rain in this church, because if there's no rain, they've sowed their crops, they're going to die. So no rain for 3 years. Could you imagine that? In Israel, in this life that they were living, where they rely upon crops to live, it's a terrible situation. And do you know what makes it worse? They're supposed to be God's people. This is supposed to be the promised land, flowing with milk and honey, God blessing them, providing all their needs. So it's stung. What's wrong? What's going on? Why is it like this? Well, verse 17, we know what Ahab thinks. Verse 17, when he saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" He's saying, "Elijah, it's your fault. It's your fault it's like this." No wonder, really, because if you go back to chapter 17, verse 1, Elijah appears out of nowhere. And what's the first words he says? "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." So no wonder Ahab's saying, "It's you. You've done this." But listen to Elijah's response, verse 18. "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals." So he's saying, this is the real cause of what's going on. You, king, and the people who follow you have turned away from the only true God, the God who's done everything for you, who's rescued you from Egypt, and he's called you to follow him, and you've turned away and you've followed this Baal, this something called Baal. Who's Baal? Well, he was known as a fertility god. And if pictures of him, you'd see like a lightning bolt in his hands. He was seen as like the god of storms and sun. So that's Baal. So this is shocking stuff because they've broken the first commandment that they were ever given. You shall have no other gods before me. They're turning to this Baal for rain. And there's no rain. You've seen the point. But it's not just that. As you follow Baal, you start to do things which are terrible. Child sacrifices was part of it. It was known as a kind of like, it seems like a sex cult. Their parties that they would have, I'm not even going to mention, but you can picture maybe. They're doing terrible things because of this decision. And it's so widespread in the nation, you get a sense of it because how many prophets of God are there? Elijah keeps saying, I'm the only one left, at least in an open sense. He's the only one left. How many prophets of Baal? 450. How many prophets of Asherah, another god? Another 400. So you're getting the idea of the ratio. They're saying this is how bad things have got. Okay, I think there's a principle there. In this time of crisis, the heart issue is revealed. Ahab's going around saying it's this, it's you. And it's deeper. And I think it's such an important principle for us today. Crises galore we have in our nation. And I do think there's finger-pointing going on. It's the government. Gwyneth Paltrow, a famous quote, says, it's religion. Religion's the reason for all the troubles in the world. And we're doing this. And what this chapter is telling us is, no, it's this. Stop looking horizontal. There's a root issue. There's definitely the government's to blame in some way. I'm not saying there's no blame anywhere. But there's a root issue underneath it all that we must wake up to. The root issue we must face is the same as they had here. You might say, we don't have statues. We're not bowing down to statues. We're not bowing down to pictures of gods with lightning bolts. We're not doing what they did. But when you think an idol is living for anything other than God, idols are everywhere. Family, spouse, children, career, holidays, comfort, ultimately self. Idols are everywhere. They're everywhere. They're in churches. They're everywhere we go. So it relates to us more than we first realize. And maybe if you analyzed our society, you could say, yeah, actually, the more we've moved away from God, the more atheism has prevailed. What's happened to our society? But anyway, that's a thought. But anyway, there's something else to say here, though, before we move on. There's a more particular issue here going on. And you'll find it out when you hear Elijah's question later. The issue for this people was not so much that they had outrightly rejected God. That was not their issue. It's not like the atheist out there that says, there's no God, I'm not living for him. It's not like that. It's not like the Gentiles in their day that lived without God completely. Their issue here was different. I don't know if you spotted it in the reading. These people were professing believers. They prayed. They knew their Bible. Their issue was a bit different. It wasn't, I'm not having God at all. I'm not having the God of the Bible, the Lord at all. Their issue was, I want the Lord plus something. That was their particular issue. It's this kind of sitting on the fence, as we're going to find out. I'm not really all in with God, but I am a bit. But I'm also in with something else. And again, that is very relevant for us again today. Today's example might be the person who comes to church. They love church. They love the community. They feel the love. They believe in a sense. I kind of believe this, yeah, seems true, but I'm not all in. I haven't got all in with Christ. I'm part in, but I'm on this kind of fence. I haven't been baptized, haven't professed. I'm not willing to follow him wherever he says. It's that kind of situation. Is that someone here? Or it could even be Christians. We've jumped all in. We're here now. We're with Christ. I've made that step. But slowly, I'm doing this. I'm slowly kind of moving back to the middle again. And there's stuff here that are drawing me. And I'm giving him less and less of my heart and time and attention. And I seem to be following this more, whatever it is. And I seem to be listening to this more. And do you see how it happens? So that's the specific issue in this chapter. It's not so much the atheist. It's more the cultural Christian or the struggling, backslidden Christian. Anyway, so we kind of zoomed in. And I just want to emphasize that because you could argue that that situation is much more dangerous. At least with the atheist, they know where they stand. They need to come to God. But this person that we're describing would say, hey, I worship the Lord. I pray to him. Yes, I don't maybe give him all of me, but there's part of me. That counts for something. It's more dangerous, isn't it? So it's a really important thing for us to consider this morning. But that's the situation. Now, secondly, the question. Elijah asks a question into this situation that cuts right through. Verse 21. He gathers all the people together and he comes near to them and says, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." Essentially saying, how long are you going to remain undecided on this? How long are you going to try and have both? You have to make a call. And he gives two reasons why in this question. I don't know if you spotted it. The first reason he gives is, it's impossible to do this. It's actually not possible. There's some things in life you can have both of. I'm going to give you a great example. I had a really tough decision to make at a weekend away that I was on. I had to choose between brown or white bread for breakfast. That was tough. Do I want the healthier brown option or do I want the more soft and delicious white option? But then Hovis fixes it, doesn't it? They make best of both. I don't have to decide anymore. I've got both. Or maybe you've struggled one day to decide between coffee and tea. Do I want a coffee? Do I want tea? It's obviously got to be coffee, but some people really struggle with this. And apparently in China, they just have both in one cup. Someone told me that. I might not be true, but someone told me this at work, that they mix coffee and tea together. Why choose? Have both. But you can't do that here. Elijah says it in his question. We're talking about God. If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal, one of them's got to be God. We're talking about the creator of the universe. We're talking about the one above all. We're talking about the one who's given me everything, breath, life. I have to choose. It makes me think of those Westerns where they say, this town ain't big enough. I was going to do an American accent. This town ain't big enough for the both of us. You could say the universe isn't big enough for two gods. You could even say my heart isn't big enough for two. One has to reign. There's one seat on the throne of my heart. It's got to be either God or ... even me. He's cornered them, hasn't he? He's cornered them. Essentially, he's saying this fence you're sitting on doesn't actually exist. There's no fence. You're either in or out. Okay, that's the first thing. He's appealing to their logic. He's saying this isn't logically possible. But he gives a second reason. He starts to address heart deeper. It's not just impossible, he's saying. It's miserable when you try and live like this. Did you notice it in the question? How long will you go limping between two different opinions? That word limping, it's like lame. It's like someone who's had an injury. That's the picture he's given. So picture this injured person falling around, in pain, hopping, never stable, never secure, no rest. That's what it's like in this middle state, he says. When you're trying to serve two masters, you're limping through life. What a question. He gets right to the heart and he cuts. He's appealing to the logic. He's appealing to the emotion. How long, he says. How long? We can fill in the blank maybe with our own gods. If self is God, follow him. If money is God, follow him. And so on. But the question, what do they answer? Verse 21. They've got to answer. He's left them no choice. And the people did not answer him a word. Verse 21. Tumbleweed. over the scene. It's strange, isn't it? Don't they want this misery to end? Don't they want to finally settle on the truth? Well, they might not answer, but God is going to answer for them. That's the third thing, the answer. The answer. Verse 22, let's imagine this. So Elijah says to the people, this is the proposition. I have a proposal for you. I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. So that's the proposition. Try and picture it. We've got the Lord on this side, the God of the Bible, the Lord who revealed himself to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And then we've got Baal on this side, this kind of storm sun god. And we've got their prophets. So we've got poor little Elijah over here by himself, just a lonely prophet. And you've got 450 over here. Can you imagine the scale? And then you've got this huge crowd. You've got a stadium crowd. All Israel. How big was it? I don't know. But all Israel. And then you've got these two bulls. You've got one bull that's going to be over here, and you've got another bull here. You've got two altars. And who's the winner? Who's going to be the victor of this? The God who answers by fire. That's a proposition. And everyone says, yeah, that makes sense. All the people answered, yeah, it's well spoken. It makes perfect sense, because only God could answer by fire from heaven. So everyone's in agreement here. Yeah, we like that. We like this. So that's the proposition. So what actually happens? Well, first, let's turn to Baal and his many prophets. Note this, everything is in their favor. I love that the suggestion was that fire should come down from heaven. Who's Baal? The storm god who carries the lightning bolt. This is his domain. He should cause fire. He does lightning. So he should cause fires. He's the sun god. The sun's a ball of fire. This is his domain. Perfect for him. Great. I think there's confidence on this side. There's confidence. Yes, we like this. Verse 25. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose for yourselves one bull. They get to choose. Notice that. And prepare it first. They get to go first. For you are many. And call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it. And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it. Okay, so we're building up now. Verse 26 continued. And they called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. Imagine it, 450 voices. O Baal, answer us. Nothing. O Baal, answer us. Silence. Over and over and over for hours. Can you picture it? It gets to midday now. Nothing. 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 The cries get louder. And Elijah cuts in from this side and starts mocking. Verse 27. Cry aloud. Cry louder. For he is a god. Either he's musing or relieving himself, going to the toilet. Or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be wakened. Baal still doesn't answer. He's being mocked. He's still not answering. Nothing. So they start to step it up. And here's where it starts to get gruesome. Glad the kids have gone off into the back now. Cutting themselves. Blood everywhere. It's gruesome. It's horrible. And what does that say about what they think of their God? I have to cut myself to get his attention. Cause myself pain. Do you hear me yet? What does that say? A cruel existence, isn't it? And it goes on and on and on. All the way to the evening sacrifice. There's no intermission. I'm trying to imagine the crowd here. The crowd are watching this for hours. Did they go off and get lunch? And they come back, oh, they're still doing it. Can you imagine the scene? It's embarrassing. It's tragic. And everyone sees it. And then this is it, verse 29. The end of verse 29 just sums it up. No one answered. No one paid attention. Just picture these prophets lying on top of this altar, cut, blood everywhere. It just captures the tragedy of living for idols. Graphically, this is what it looks like when you live for something other than God's. What's your God? Maybe you feel, no, it hasn't done that to me. But this is the reality. Can you relate in any way? Letdowns? Nothing when you needed it most. No one cares. Tragic picture, but it's also a tragic failure. Case closed here. Baal can't be God. That's the point. Okay, but what about the Lord then? The God over here. Elijah's God. Well, now we turn to him. One prophet alone. Just one man. And he says to people, come near to me. There's confidence there, isn't it? Come near to me. Come near to me. He's a confident man in his God. And what's interesting is he handicaps himself further just to make the point. You notice all the stuff that he does? It's like he's trying to make it as hard as possible. He's already won verse 450. I mean, we make a big deal when a man's sent off in football. 450 and one, this is on another level. But now he digs a deep trench around his altar and fills it with water. And anyone with any logic says, wait a minute, no, don't do that. If you want fire, you don't put water. And he puts jugs, second time, third time, it's everywhere. Water's everywhere. Confidence in the man. He does it three times. It's like maybe a race where you give someone a head start. I don't know if you've done that before. I certainly don't do that. But there's a confidence. Maybe you're playing FIFA. Some people at the back might be interested in this bit. And you can do handicaps in FIFA where you start 10-0 down. You're so confident of victory. I'll give you 10 goals. 10 goal start. That's the kind of thing going on here. But why? Is it because he's boasting? No, because it's not about Elijah. It's about the God who answers by fire. So what he's doing here is he's saying, I don't want any excuse. If God does this, no one can say it was a magic trick or it was that no one can say any. It will be so clear that it was God. You see what? It's going to be undeniable. I don't want any excuses, he says. I'm going to make it as obvious as possible. And then comes the moment, verse 36. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, oh, picture this. Oh, Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have turned their hearts back. What a contrast, isn't it? The prophets of Baal, there's no repeating here. He just calmly and confidently prays to his God once. And it's a prayer of faith, isn't it? He's confident. But yet there's still earnestness there. He's not cold. He says, answer me, answer me. There's still that earnestness, but still he's confident. What? Contrast the two. Contrast the two. He's not dancing around. He's not repeating and repeating and repeating. And can you imagine the scene at this point? The tension in the air. The prophets of Baal bleeding over here. And everyone's just waiting. Elijah called this scene. Is it going to happen? The tension in the air. Everything's on the line. Is God going to answer? Verse 38. Then, immediately, the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. A miracle. Licked up the water. You've never seen that. This fire from heaven. You've never seen such a thing. Do you see the point? This is undeniable, proven beyond all doubt. The Lord is God. They say it, verse 39. They can't deny it. The Lord, they're falling on their faces. He is God. He really is. The Lord, he is God. They finally say it and they act, don't they? By the end of our passage, they're seizing the prophets of Baal. They're slaughtering them. It's graphic. It's dramatic. They're taking action now. And you're thinking from this point on, everything's going to change now, isn't it? Of course it will. Baal's been defeated. This is it now. No more idols. It's settled. It's finished. Ahab, he's going to follow the king who led this nation in idolatry. He's seen it. Jezebel, his wife, she's going to hear about it. The whole nation's going to change. No more famine, rain, back with God. But here's where things get very strange. It's a final thing, the fourth thing, the mystery. Think about this. The evidence could not have been clearer. You agree? They even cry, he's God. Yes, he is, convinced. But nothing changes. Baal survives somehow. You get to the end of 1 Kings and Baal's there again. Shall I read it? Chapter 22, it's on page 306. The next king after Ahab. Listen to this, verse 53, the very last chapter of 1 Kings. The next king after Ahab, he served Baal. I thought Baal was defeated. He worshipped Baal. How? How did Baal survive this? What happened? It's very confusing. It's very strange. And then there's Ahab. He witnessed this. He doesn't change, really. He has a moment of repentance at one point, but not really. And then Jezebel, she hears about this, and she doesn't say, oh, the Lord, he's God. What's her reaction to everything that just happened? I want to kill this prophet. I'm going to kill Elijah. She's more against God as a result of this proof. It's strange. Do you not find it strange? I find the whole thing very strange. It's as though the showdown never happened. It's as though we've rewinded and we're back to that question that Elijah asks. It's just as relevant now as it was before the showdown. How long? How long are you going to do this? It's strange. And what makes this even more strange is it's not a one-off in the Bible. This happens all over the place. You see, Pharaoh. Remember Pharaoh? For those of you who know, how many plagues did it take? You think one plague. He said, I am the Lord, let my people go. Who's the Lord that I should let be? One plague. Whoa. Nope. Second plague. Nope. Third plague. Nope. Still refuses. He considers it at one point. Yeah. Still refuses. On the fence. 10 plagues. It's not an isolated incident, this. But then I think the clearest example is when Christ himself comes. Not fire from heaven. God himself comes down from heaven in person. This is a whole other level. And the Pharisees get to see him. They witness his miracles. They witness him raise Lazarus from the dead after 4 days. They see everything he does. And you're thinking, bow down. God is here. Worship him. But rather than following, they don't even stay neutral. They only get more angry. The more evidence that's brought to them, the more angry and the more against they become. Even after the resurrection, they're trying to cover it up. We can't let this out. It's saying there's something drastically wrong. What's going on? And it still happens today. Do you know that the Bible says that Romans 1 tells us that every time you walk around this world, God is speaking to you. Every time you see a tree, every time you see the sky, every time you look in the mirror, it says, God is here. God is real. Every time I look at the complexity of an eye, my hand, it's all saying, declaring to me, God did this. God's real. And what's been the prevailing response in this country for the last 30, 40, 50, maybe more years? No God. What actually happened was it just came from nothing. And in fact, actually, it was an explosion. You know, those things that destroy things. But this explosion didn't do that. This explosion just made horses and mountains and people. And you're thinking, strange. Still the same thing. They're doing the same thing. All this evidence. And even here in church, we have this completed book. How many prophecies did Jesus fulfill? One would be amazing. Hundreds. Where he's born of a virgin, and he fulfills it. And this whole book is about him. And you're reading through and you're saying, it really is all about him. And he comes and he does miracles and he dies and he rises. And sometimes I think even the claim itself is amazing for someone to boldly say, I'm going to rise from the dead. Muhammad never claimed that. No one else claimed that. But then to go and do it, and that it spreads on that basis, and disciples are willing to die for it. We've got this avalanche of evidence continuously saying, God saying, I'm here, I'm here. And yet Elijah's question still remains. I'm not all in. I'm still trying to keep one foot here and one foot here. I'm still refusing to get all in with this God. Some of us here have refused to come to him. You've heard sermon after sermon. He's appealed to you. Some of us here are Christians and we've tasted such blessings, and yet I still can't seem to fully get in. It's that question remains, how long? It's like God is saying, how many prophecies do you want fulfilled? How many times must a man rise from the dead? How many Christians must you witness being transformed before your very eyes? How many sunsets must you witness? How many sermons must you hear? It begs the question, doesn't it? Why? Is it that God needs to do more? Is it that there needs to be more evidence? Maybe we need another showdown. We need another showdown between God and so-and-so. Maybe Pharaoh needed 20 plagues. Maybe there needed to be 600 Baal prophets. Maybe that would convince. No. Imagine you witness the detective and he was trying to solve this serious murder mystery. And he keeps finding such clear evidence pointing him to the same suspect over and over again. And then the deal breaker, he gets video evidence of the actual murder and he sees the face of the guy. And he still says, no, it's still not him. It's still not him. What would you conclude about that detective? Not he needs more evidence, but for some reason, he doesn't want it. And that's the issue here. I think the only conclusion we can draw as we look at Ahab, as we look at Jezebel, as we look at this poor nation that's going to be sent into exile because they did not learn, they did not come, the only conclusion we can draw is they don't want it. They know God is God, but for some reason, they don't want him. They don't want him. Baal still offers me something. I know you're God, but Baal still has a place. Sin still has a place. I know you're God. I know it, though. I know it. There's no denying that. But I still want this. That's still doing something for me. It's like sin is offering something that God can't. It's like I believe God's God, but I'm not believing he's all sufficient. I'm not believing he's enough. I still need God plus. He's somehow still not everything. It's like they believed it, but not with their hearts. Something like that. I think it's the very issue of the demons. You know that verse in the New Testament, it says, even the demons believe and shudder. They believe what they believed here. He's God. Yes, he's God. I believe that. But they shudder. They don't want it. They don't want it. Isn't that maybe what's going on here? And I think this is so helpful for us this morning and me. Please hear me on this, that this has really been a challenge for me. It says this, I think, to us. If you're on the fence this morning, if you've never jumped in with Christ, if you've always been half in, you've never fully followed, you've never got baptized and publicly professed his name to everyone, I'm his. Or if you're a Christian here and slowly other things have just taken over and God's been squeezed out slowly, it's likely not because you don't believe God is God, that he's almighty, that he's creator, that he's powerful. It's likely down to the fact, I don't think he's enough. I can't give him my all. It's too risky. I'm going to hedge my bets. Bit of Baal, bit of this. It's too risky. I believe something else is better still. This is why believers drift. This is why we turn to sin so easily. This is why atheists don't believe today. This is why people sit on the fence week after week. This passage, it challenges. It probes us deep down. It's like it's asking us, do I really want him? Do I really want the God that I believe in? It says, my great need is not just to believe God is God, but that he's worthy and that he alone is enough. And he really is better than anything else. Do you know, I asked Andy Ball, he doesn't know I'm sharing this. I hope, I didn't even get his permission. But Andy, I asked, what's the secret? I see this passionate man living for Jesus. He's got such passion. He's been through so much. He's still living for Christ. He's still living for Christ after all these years. And I said to him, what's the secret? What's the secret? And he said, when I was a teenager, God convinced me that he is better than anything else. That was it. So as we close, I want us to be moved in our hearts this morning, not simply to believe God is God, but to be moved in our hearts for him. And to do that, I want us to just look at this scene again very quickly, and hopefully something of this will come across. Look again at this scene. Did you notice that scene that we were just describing is so much more than a miracle fire show? It's so much more than just proof God is God. Just look again. Look at those prophets of Baal crying out, cutting themselves. Answer us in our time of need. Answer. Yet nothing. No answer. Doesn't that remind you of limping in this world without God? This lonely, cold existence we live, where we turn to this and we turn to that and I'm let down again. No one's really there for me. Doesn't it scream that to you? Doesn't that move you? What about when you see this one man, Elijah, and he prays and God answers immediately? No delay. It's like God is saying, I'm here. I'm ready to answer. I'm here. I'm for you. Did you see that? What about when you saw the sacrifices? What did that say? And the fire from heaven. Why that? Well, what we're witnessing here is an innocent animal being killed. And fire from heaven consuming that animal. And the crowd that are watching that deserved that. If you read Exodus, what does it say in Exodus? Anyone who worships another god, put them to death. They deserved what that animal got. They deserved the fire that consumed. And who gets consumed? The poor innocent. And doesn't that remind you of Christ on the cross? The innocent one, in my place, condemned he stood. He's consumed by the fire. It's like God is saying to Israel in this showdown, come back. I've done everything. I'm ready to forgive you. You've done all of that and I'll still take you back. Look, the fire's consumed the animal. Look, it didn't consume you. I'm not going to consume you. Are you seeing? He's wooing. He's calling. It's not just an intellectual, oh, God is God. There's something deeper. He's drawing them. Elijah even says it himself. Turn the hearts of them back, he says. Turn the hearts, not just the heads. Do you see? In light of all of this then, doesn't Elijah's question land deeper? How long, he says? How long? How long? How long will you try and follow Jesus and the world? Jesus and yourself. Jesus and your sin. Christians here, aren't we tired of never being all in? Never knowing the peace of a fully surrendered heart before God? Isn't it weary and limping around and sometimes going here and then going back to here and I'm let down and I'm going back here again? Isn't it wearying? And others here who are on the fence this morning and you've never jumped in, how long before you leave sin and self behind? How long before you confess sin and you put your trust in him once and for all? Before you step out in faith and actually follow? Before you publicly even profess his name in baptism? How long are you going to wait? How long? Elijah's logic here is clear. If the Lord is God, then follow him. We should. But I think it's this. When I see that the Lord is this God, such love, such patience, he's this good. If I see that, then surely following him no matter the cost, will be the easiest decision I'll ever make.